So thanks for being here. My name is Vishal. First, I'd like to thank Lalit for arranging this talk at such short notice. My name is Vishal, and I work for the Stockholm Environment Institute, the US Center. That's SEIUS. You can see the website up here. SEIUS is an international nonprofit research organization. We work on basically three themes: energy, climate change, and water resources, under the umbrella of sustainability planning. So planning and policy is kind of the direction and motivation of all the research we do. We work with state and local governments, non-government organizations, UN organizations, environmental consultants. We work with pretty much all kinds of organizations. I work with the Water Resources Program, and I'm based in Davis, California. I started working with them in February, and before that, last year, I completed my PhD at Cornell University in the Soil, Crop, and Atmospheric Sciences. I have plenty of experience working in India and in the Northeast US. So the title is a bit long, but basically, I'm going to share this modeling effort using WEEP. It's a water resources modeling in the Sierra Nevada watersheds of California. I'll start by giving an overview of the salient features of the California waterscape, some of the problems it faces, and what are the institutional mechanisms by which the government of California, the state government, is really pushing climate change research geared towards sounder policy going into the coming decades. And after that, I'll start actually describing the model and showing some results before ending. So California, this is a state map of California. It's a terrain map on the left here. This is a precipitation map. It may not be very clear, but basically it has diverse landscapes and diverse climates. Is anyone from California here? No. Okay. So this is Central Valley over here, which produces 50% of California's, the US's fruit and vegetable crops. And the Sierra Nevada is a 650 kilometer ridgeline. You get about 2 feet of snow at the foothills. You get up more than 30 feet of snow in the highlands. And I'll explain how the snow hydrology, or the snow accumulation and snow melt in the Sierra Nevada, is very crucial to California's water supply. So you have about 1.5 meters of precipitation in the mountains. You have about 800 millimeters here. You have about 1 meter along the coast. But in the southeast deserts, you have only about 50 millimeters. So basically, you have 75% of rainfall precipitation endowment in California comes north of Sacramento here, but 75% of demand is in the south, LA and other regions. So the distribution system, the water resources distribution system, relies very heavily on Sierra Nevada snowpack. California experiences a Mediterranean climate, which is winter precipitation and then a long dry summer. So between November and March, you get precipitation. And then the snow melts starting from, say, April onwards. And that snow melt is stored in something like 1,400 dams and thousands of kilometers of aqueducts, canals. It is one of the most altered water resources systems, if not the most altered water resources infrastructure in the world. And pretty much most of it is going into Central Valley and then down south to Southern California. And basically, irrigation accounts for about 80% of all developed water use. And groundwater is severely overdrafted. It is not regulated. Those are some of the issues facing it. On the right here, what you see here, except for the blue, which are the main rivers, all the other colors are the different projects, the canals, aqueducts that transfer water from one part of California to the other. Overall demand in California exceeds supply of developed water. And now we come to a very kind of general scenario, which is true of all places, not just California, that the actual distribution of water across competing demands is a result of a series of trade-offs between the different users of water. And so understanding the trade-offs is vital to rational allocation of water resources. So given the limited supply, you basically have to allocate water between different sectors like agriculture and recreation, industry, domestic and environmental flows. So California, at least in the US, is thanks to Governor Schwarzenegger, is at the lead of climate change related policy, understanding climate change, its impacts on different sectors of California resources and economy, and then figuring out impacts, climate change impacts on those sectors, and then figuring out mitigation and adaptation. So it's in terms of policy oriented research, it is very much the leader in the US. So the governor basically set forth a big impetus into this kind of research across government agencies, academia, so all the universities, NGOs, environmental consultants. They are all doing concerted research under the umbrella of at least three huge funded projects called the Scenarios Project, the Climate Scenarios Project, the Governor's Report, which has to report back every 2 years, and the California Water Plan Update. So there are these institutional mechanisms which have created, one of the things it's created is that the government agencies like the California Department of Water Resources, the California Energy Center, they are now required to produce peer-reviewed research as part of this program that was set in. So they collaborate with academia, they collaborate with agencies, other agencies, and they are now used to the idea of producing peer-reviewed literature research. So basically, they produce papers that have been reviewed by the scientific community. It's like saying, I come from Bangalore, so it's like saying the Bangalore Water Supply and Sewerage Board is producing not just reports, but basically scientific papers, which has been reviewed and by the public and by the scientific community. So that's one of the really good things about this institutional framework. Now on the right here is one of the papers that comes, the white papers that come out of this governor's report every 2 years. And this is actually a paper written by an example of the many papers were written by my colleagues at SEIUS. And this paper was on climate change impacts on water for agriculture in the Sacramento Valley in California. And it was also an application of WEEP, this software that I'm telling you about. So the Scenarios Project identified three warming scenarios going into 2100, into the year 2100. So they picked among the scores or hundreds of models that are available, the climate models, they picked three models and they picked three emission scenarios. So they had nine projections of climate going into 2100. And based on that, they said that we will concentrate on our research on climate change impacts based on these three kind of ranges of warming, which I've just put up over here. So all the climate models that they looked at showed they were consistent in saying that yes, the climate will warm up by varying degrees into 2100. So the trend was positive and consistent among all the models. But if you know anything about climate models, you know that their results are very different from one model to the other. It also depends on the emission scenarios and so on. So in terms of precipitation, there was much more variability among the climate models. And so they cannot say from these models yet whether the precipitation is likely to increase or decrease in California. This came out of the 2006 governor's report. But they do say that the seasonal pattern, that is the Mediterranean seasonal pattern of winter rainfall or precipitation and then a long dry season will remain into the end of the century, which is kind of similar to the climate change report for India, which says that the monsoon pattern will and the dry season will remain the same. They just predict an intensification of the Indian summer monsoon. So they assessed risks, the 2006 report, to many different sectors. The key features to the impacts on the water resources sector was that the Sierra Nevada snowpack could be reduced by 2100 by about 70 to 90%. So over here is the historic snow accumulation. This one is 40% remaining under low warming conditions and 20% remaining under the medium warming range. Along with that, they face severe increased water supply shortages given that the population is projected to increase from 35 to 55 million by mid-century, with negative impacts on agriculture. sea level has already risen by about 7 inches in the last 100 years, which is this graph here. And they project about 20 to 35, so about 3 feet of sea level rise in San Francisco Bay, this is, by the end of the century. Yeah.
In spite of the snowpack decrease, there's precipitation supposedly going to be the same. So instead of snow, it becomes rain.
Yes.
So
yeah.
Precipitation on that level is the same.
There, yeah. There is no consistency among the different models that say that that you know most of the models do not say that there'll be an increase or decrease in precipitation.
Okay. I asked about the amount of precipitation.
Yeah.
And that seems it's going to remain the same even though the snowpack will decrease.
Yes, the snowpack will decrease, and I'll explain why actually, because we model that. So how do we do this kind of research that I've kind of sketched out? You basically use software models, you use water resources models, you use hydrologic models to look at local scale or regional scale planning and research in the water resources sector. So we use, and our collaborators use, and the California Department of Water Resources uses WEEP as one of the tools. One of the key features of WEEP is that it integrates hydrology as well as water resources allocation. So I've explained water resources allocation, which is, you know, you're allocating water among competing demands, like for agriculture, urban, and so on. Now, in terms of hydrology is nothing but estimating the water balance, like what happens to precipitation, how much of it goes into the soil, how much of it goes into groundwater, how much of it runs off as surface runoff, and how much of it evapotranspirates. So the hydrological cycle or the water balance and allocation routines are combined into this one platform. And most of the tools that people use do not have both these components. So they use a different tool for one and another tool for the other. So it's not the only tool that does it, but most of the research in California is not doing it within one platform. So apart from those two aspects, in terms of allocations, you can also model reservoirs, hydropower, water supply, water quality, and groundwater, as well as economics. And like I mentioned before, it is ideal for what-if scenario investigations, be it management or land use scenarios, or climate change impact scenarios. So a management scenario might be that, say, if you're facing shortages, what would happen if you built another reservoir? That's kind of a scenario. Okay, will it help? Will it not help? Or you could want to, you want to take off a reservoir because you want to release water into the streams for the fish to move up, like the salmon in California. They move back to the headwaters to spawn. And that link has been broken all over California. And so if you want to revive those fisheries, maybe you want to take away some dams or release more water downstream of the dams. So all those are kinds of scenarios that you can build in one tool. So you build the base model, and then you can build as many scenarios as you want with the same model. So the idea is to have a tool that is really generic. So you build it for an area, and then you pass it on to different people who may have different interests and different questions that they are interested in answering. So coming to the Sierra Nevada, we had built, my colleagues had built individual hydrologic models for 13 watersheds covering the entire western Sierra Nevada. But this application I'm showing you is an integration of four of these watersheds. It's called the CABI region. It stands for the Cozumnes, the American Bear, and Yuba rivers. Those are four rivers draining the west, four of the rivers draining the western Sierra. And the operations, they are very heavily manipulated. There are many, many hydropower plants, canals, aqueducts, and so on, transferring water from one river to the other and back. And so the operations are very much very integrated. So it makes sense to build an application that integrates those four watersheds. So the background and motivation for this particular research was that there were more than 95 licensed hydropower projects in this area that were coming up for renewal. The licenses were coming up for renewal. So it's the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission that awards these licenses to companies. So all across California, these licenses last for about 30 to 50 years, and now they're coming up for renewal. So environmental stakeholders in this region were interested in engaging with these licensees, the companies, as well as FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, to say, to argue some points from their point of view, because the first thing is that FERC does not require the licensees to include climate change impacts on their licensing process. So they're not required to show what might be the effect of climate change on hydropower or water supply or anything like that. But since the licenses last for 30 to 50 years, that doesn't make any sense anymore. And so the environmental stakeholders, American Rivers and a consortium of other environmental stakeholders, were interested in pushing the licensees to say, you guys have to consider climate change. It's going to impact your own economy. It's going to impact your own water resources operations. So they wanted to push them. But the licensees were not going to build, they used their own sophisticated models, but they were not going to build something so, because nobody really knows how to do that among the licensees, how to look at climate change impacts. It's still kind of in the beginning stages. So they came to us because we do it for a living. And the environmental stakeholders came to us to look into that aspect of it. The second thing they wanted to do was, again, build a generic tool so that among the stakeholders who hired us, the people who are interested in fish flows, for example, increasing flows for fish, they could, you know, build a scenario that is more favorable towards some of those concerns. Whereas the licensee themselves might be interested in seeing what might happen if they remove a dam or increase the height of a dam or so on. So it needed to be quite a generic tool. So for these reasons, they came to us and we built this combined model. So what we did first, we built the base case scenario, which is called a reference scenario. The time period that we used was 1981 to 2000 at a weekly time step. So we built the base case scenario, and when you build a base case scenario, you have to calibrate the model. Basically, that means you're saying that the model works, that is predicting things, at least the historical record, pretty well. And you do it based in one or two different ways. In this case, if you're modeling hydrology, then you want to have some means of saying that the hydrology is being modeled well. And you do that by comparing historical observed stream flow against your model stream flow. So that's the first thing that you do. You do a hydrologic calibration. And then in this case, we were also interested in hydropower because these were hydropower projects we were looking at. So we want to model the hydropower, historic hydropower over the 20 years pretty well too. So once you've built that, you can then build the scenarios on top of it, be it management or climate change. In this case, we built three generic climate warming scenarios. We did not use global climate model data for this project. We used it for other projects. We just said, okay, let's just up the temperature over historic by 2, 4, and 6 degrees centigrade respectively and see what happens to hydrology and hydropower and demonstrate and basically check if there's any change in hydropower. I mean, we all know that there is. Like we all know that if you over pump, your groundwater will fall. But you don't really know by how much, right? So in this case, we do know that, yeah, obviously hydropower will change because stream flows will change, but you can't just say out of the blue or on the back of an envelope by how much it would change. So we wanted to build this model and verify what would be approximately the degree of change in these variables.
How many rivers for this model?
Four major rivers.
Four
main rivers, but I'm coming to that right now, actually.
Okay.
Yeah, how it was discretized, I'll tell you.
We
have a snowmelt algorithm.
Yeah.
So this is the region. These are the four watersheds. This is an extension just of these two watersheds. Yub stands for the Yuba River, the Bear River, the American River, the Cozumnes. And the total area was about 11,000 square kilometers. You can see some of the main reservoirs over here. And this is what the model looks like in Weep. Now, it's very dense. I will show you a zoomed-in view of it. But basically, you go from the public documents that I'll show you in a couple of slides, and you build a model like this. I'm going to explain that in a little bit. So basically, the model includes 25 reservoirs, 39 tunnels, aqueducts, and so on, 33 hydropower plants, 14 transmission links, to 13 major nodes from which water was being supplied by different agencies to towns and municipalities and agriculture and so on. And it includes 324 catchments over which hydrology is calculated. So I'll explain that to you. This is a zoomed in version of the WEEP schematic. This is a schematic view. What you have in the background here are sub-watersheds. So using GIS analysis, the huge watersheds are divided into sub-watersheds. Sub-watersheds were divided based on any point where there was any kind of operational infrastructure present. So if there was a dam present, then at that dam, there was a sub-watershed delineated. If there was a diversion from one river to another, then at that point, a sub-watershed was delineated. Then within the sub-watershed, the landscape was divided up into X number of catchments. So these green dots here are catchments over here. In this case, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 catchments. So this whole area has been divided up into 5 parcels, basically. And over each of those parcels, the hydrology is calculated. So precipitation is input, and the hydrological algorithm calculates how much of it is going into soil, into groundwater, into the stream as surface runoff and evaporation. So there are 324 of these. So for every time step for 20 years, for 324 of these catchments, the hydrology is being calculated and then routed down the rivers. So the streams are flowing westward here. So in this schematic, you see all of the tools that you have. These are the objects: river diversion, reservoirs, demand sites, catchments, transmission links, wastewater plants, hydropower, flow requirements, return flows. All of these you drag and drop to build your model. So if you wanted to build a model for, say, Oroville, you would drag and drop probably one of these demand sites and start building your model based on where your water is coming from maybe groundwater or surface water or whatever it is. So basically, using that kind of procedure, we built this very intensely elaborate model. I'm going to skip over the GIS analysis in this slide, but this is basically how for each of the catchments, we characterized it in terms of land use, land cover, soils, and climate. So coming to that, this is an example of how for each of those 324 catchments in the data view, these are the different tabs by which you enter data. In this case, we had 6 land use classes, agriculture, forest, grassland, and a few more, impervious, urban, and so on. And for each of them, these are the data that you enter, soil water capacity. For the hydrologists in the audience, this will be familiar, but basically these are the properties that you enter, the parameters you enter for each land use to simulate basically the hydrology. You need all of these parameters. So we use some geomorphological information when we're doing water quality modeling. So if you want to test, for example, if the hydrology, I guess, is different for each geomorphological classification, then you build a model which has X number of different geomorphological classifications. Whereas in this case, we are just looking at land cover. So our classification is based on land cover. But it's flexible enough. If you know how each geomorphological unit behaves differently, if you know the response. So that's the land use tab. And then for each catchment, you also have all the climate data that you enter. This is the precipitation, temperature, humidity, wind. Some of these, like albedo, melting point, and so on, are specific to snow hydrology. And you can read the files in from just text files or CSV files, or you could just enter it using a monthly data. So in this particular model, we had data for physiography and climate and so on from these sources. But what I find very interesting is this side over here, which is the data sources for all the operations. So for example, all the reservoir characteristics, all the hydropower characteristics of all the plants that are there in the area, they are required to put up publicly. So you can get all of that publicly. Okay, so it's part of their process there. So I didn't have to go and ask them for anything because they're required to put it up publicly. So for example, this is just a very partial network diagram available on the public documentation websites from those projects, that companies have to put up. And this we translate, basically this kind of network map, we translate into something that looks like this. So for example, here, this is one of the 33 reservoirs we modeled, and this is a hydropower plant. And in Veep, we can put in all the data. This is likely a flood control zone. In the wet season, they keep it empty so that they keep it about half empty, the reservoirs, so that during spring snow melt, there's enough storage capacity in the reservoirs. So you can model, you can put in all of that data to, so that you model your reservoirs right. And similarly, for all these pipes and conveyances, you can put in the flow data and lengths of pipes and all of that information. So like I said, we need to first calibrate the hydrology. We took our calibrated hydrology parameters from the other hydrological models we had done all across the Western Sierra, and we just transferred them into our integrated model of four of these watersheds. And we used 19 sub-watersheds where there was observed stream flow to calibrate our model. So coming to results, we'll start with hydrology. This is historic hydrology. This is an example where flow is on the y-axis. This weekly time step is on the x-axis. The solid line is observed stream flow, and the dotted line is a modeled stream flow. So basically, in the next few graphs, I'm just showing that the model is performing hydrology pretty well by comparing modeled stream flow versus observed stream flow. So here's another example for another site. This is monthly on the x-axis, monthly time steps, and stream flows on the y-axis. This is another site where we had observed stream flows. And finally, this is just one example of the snow gauges we use. There are 300 snow gauges across the Sierras, just reflecting just how important it is for California water supply. And they actually use the snow accumulation at different months during the winter season to forecast as part of their forecasting equation for the coming summer period. So this is the kind of data we use to calibrate our snow algorithms. And again, it's comparing simulated or modeled versus observed snowpack. Coming to results on hydropower, again, historic hydropower, what we have here is the annual average for 20 power plants. YBDS and MFP are two different projects. Like I said, you can think of them as two different private companies operating the different power plants in that area. So YBDS is about 15 hydropower plants, and MFP is the Middle Fork project, has about five power plants. The y-axis is the modeled hydropower, x-axis is the observed, and in this case, it's all the annual totals, so 20 years of annual totals. Again, it's the y-axis is modeled hydropower, and x-axis is the observed hydropower. So that's on the annual scale. On the left here, at the bottom, is the same data broken up seasonally into four seasons. Basically, checking at what time step, at what resolution, the model is performing well or not. So basically, we are saying over here that at annual, seasonal, and monthly data here, the hydropower is well simulated. This is what the results tab looks for hydropower as an example in Veep, in the model interface. And from here, you can export to Excel or CSV and so on. So now we're coming to some results. So far, we looked at results just on based on historic data. Here are some results on climate warming impacts. So these are the four watersheds. These are the historic stream flow into the reservoirs downstream of these watersheds. And the same data is displayed in this graph. These are the watersheds, 2, 4, 6 degrees centigrade warming. And this is the change, annual inflow change over historic. So you can see that there is a consistent trend in greater reductions in stream flows with greater warming across the watersheds. The degrees are different. The degree of change is different across each watershed. But basically, it's about from 4 to 10 or 13%. The second thing we look at is change in the snowmelt and a shift in the peak runoff. So the peak flow happens during snowmelt, which is usually during April. But as a result of climate warming, several things happen. One is that more of the precipitation falls as rainfall instead of snow, right? This is what you were mentioning earlier. Secondly, is that whatever snow does accumulate on the ground melts earlier. So for both reasons, you have a shift to earlier in the spring of the peak flows. And this has lots of consequences on the water resources infrastructure. So imagine if you are keeping the reservoir fairly empty for April flows, flow peaks, but that's going to shift to March. If you keep operating the reservoir as is, then you're going to run into some risks in March of flooding, right? So that's very relevant even like in the Indian context. You know, you have so many cases where they are forced to release water from dams, and dams cause floods instead of being preventative in many cases in India. It's happened again and again. So to the extent that if you just have like a fixed way of operating all of these infrastructure, you're going to run into problems with climate change. Basically, it's a demonstration of that. So basically, in the Sierra Nevadas, you also see that there is a relationship between the decrease in snowmelt over here on the y-axis and the elevation. And you see that the decrease in snowmelt is highest for the middle elevations and not for the lower and highest elevations. Basically, because in the lower elevations, it's anyway the hydrology is driven by rainfall runoff processes. Snow processes are not that much that much significant in those low elevation watersheds. And in the highest elevation zones, the temperatures are anyway cold enough that it even some warming does not impact it too much. But in the middle elevations, the temperatures are just below freezing, and a little bit of warming is enough to cause a big change in the hydrology. So in this example, I took you through some of our very recent applications in the Western Sierra Nevada. It mostly concentrated on hydropower and hydrology, but we work in all these different sectors with WEEP, and we have a number of applications around the world. I have some small presentations that I could show you some of those applications, what they look like. There was some very interesting applications with water quality in Lebanon, where they looked at the economics and feasibility of two alternate wastewater treatment plant infrastructure in Lebanon using WEEP. And there was another example which is relevant, I think, to India, with where they looked at groundwater policy in Spain using WEEP, in which they, just like in India, the groundwater was dropping fast, and there was a lot of over-exploitation and overdraft. So they decided to use WEEP and say, okay, what if we have regulations on groundwater? What if we limit groundwater use? And they asked those kinds of questions using this modeling tool. Yeah. Yeah, ecosystem requirements is something that India has lagged behind, but basically it's a recognition of the fact that water that runs into the sea, for example, is not wasted water. I mean, it's all part of the ecosystem, and rivers, not just water, but also nutrients and sediments, they transfer down into the deltas, and the entire ecosystem is built around it. So in India, there's been a huge camp that says you should not let any water out into the sea, right? Then those are the people who advocate interlinking of rivers and so on. They think it's water wasted. But this is a recognition of the fact that the ecosystem requires water. No, but the research on how much water is required is very nascent still, but there is still a recognition. So for example, in our WEEP modeling of this study area, below every reservoir, they have a fixed requirement. It's called an in-stream flow requirement. They don't know where it comes from, but there'll be like 5 CFS during the summer. You must release. And that's the priority. So this model is driven by priorities. The first priority is to release water for ecosystems. The second priority in this region is for drinking water. The third priority is for agriculture, and the fourth is for industry. So it's there. It's direct recognition has always been there, at least in California. But how they come up with those numbers is still is an area of active research. So finally, I want to just say that we are working with some people with IRD in France, the French Institute, which is supporting us with some World Bank funding to develop a glacier object in WEEP. It's being tested in the Peruvian glaciers right now in Peru. And I'm hoping that we could use some of that in the Himalayan glaciers. Basically, they're looking at glacier retreat with WEEP, and that's some very new feature of WEEP. So, like I said, we at SEIUS, we work with people around the world, and this is part of my outreach to interested people out here in India. And this is my contact information. Please feel free to download WEEP, start using it, because it's basically it's free for developing countries as long as it's a non-profit establishment. It's not free to like other environmental consultants or so on. But you can download it and start using it. It has a really fantastic tutorial online, which you can use, which I myself used when I joined SEI this February, and started learning how to use it. And I want to say that in terms of how we collaborate, it's all project-based. It's not programmatic. What that means is that we don't have like, you know, some UN or anything like that giving us a whole chunk of funds, and then we go out and do things that interest us. We basically write proposals, and it's project-based funding. So in India, I myself would like to develop programmatic funding to start with. So I'm looking around for that kind of opportunity. But we can also go with the project-based funding kind of endeavors. So I had some Google Earth animations, but you know, those are just pretty pictures. I might as well show you one. This snow stuff, right? So this is an animation of snow. This is Lake Tahoe, US, California. And this will take you through 1 year of snow simulated historically. And then the next one will take you through what will happen, what could happen if there's 4 degrees increased warming. So you'll get an idea of those, of the same data I showed you in terms of charts and tables. You can see it in a spatial way. So the darker the blue, the greater the snow accumulation for that particular time step. So this is going through 1980 at a weekly time step, and this is the ridgeline of the Sierra Nevada. So you can see if you see over here, November to March, like I said, is the wet season. You can see the snow is disappearing, only the high elevations, there's snow remaining on the ground. By May, it's gone. I'll show it to you one more time. There's no snow during the dry months, of course.
What is the height of the mountain
there? It's about 2,500 meters. Yeah, so this is the ridgeline, the deepest blue over here. Now I'm going to show you an animation of the same thing, but this is a reduction over, this is a percentage decrease over the previous animation upon 4 degrees centigrade warming. So the red color is 100%, which is all removed. You know, all of it lost for that particular week. So the warmer the color, the greater the percentage reduction in snow. So you can see here, the reds are all in the middle and lower elevations.
The model is interesting, but what have you advised the governor to do?
What we advise them to do?
Yeah.
Well, basically, at the moment, the conversation has been, or the conversation, to put it in a simple way, has been to answer the question, what are the likely impacts, right, of climate change, in this case, in the Sierra Nevada. So with these kinds of results, it's become very clear, and this is not the only research. Other people using other tools are coming up with similar results. So the idea, the fact, now with people pretty much understand, and it's pretty recent over the last 2 years, that there will be reductions in snow accumulation, and we are going to lose that snowpack. So that's one thing. So what do we do about it is the next phase of the governor's report endeavor. Like, what are the adaptation measures? So we have other projects that we are doing with local water agencies, like the El Dorado Irrigation District, where they are now talking about adaptation measures. So what do we do about it? Like, even if we cap all our greenhouse gas emissions right now, we're still going to continue to have climate change. So what do we do about it? So that's the adaptation conversation that is just beginning, and they are going to start looking at, okay, does it make sense to have a reservoir, or does it not make sense to have a reservoir? Does it make sense to have different types of crops if we have drier summers and so on? And does it make sense to operate our reservoirs differently? So one of the things that we are going to recommend is that the licensees really need to start looking at including climate change in their water resources applications as a must for getting the license approved. Because we are basically showing that your operations will change and likely that your flood control measures will not work into the future. So that's one big message that we are getting across to them. And in terms of adaptation, it's still very nascent beginnings into what we can do about it. So they are thinking about using different irrigation technologies. Basically so there are two approaches. There are supply measures and there are demand measures, right? So in terms of adaptation, supply measures are like your run-of-the-mill, dig more bore wells, increase supply is one idea, right? And or build a dam or whatever it is. From demand measures, what people look at irrigation technologies, out here you might look at rooftop rainwater harvesting, but of course rooftop rainwater harvesting is a supply measure again. So from the demand side, you might think of using flushes and showers that use less water. In fact, they did that. They did that about 6 or 7 years ago in California, and overall it reduced urban water demand significantly, just doing something like that. So they're looking at different supply and demand measure options. And then you try to figure out how to go from there. So it's a tough question, but people are trying to address it.
A statement like with higher temperatures, you will have shorter snow cover,
yeah.
You have earlier melt, you will have earlier dams full, you will have to release the water in a different pattern. For that, you don't need to study.
Well, I said before,
in order to quantify it, you might need it.
Right.
But exactly at the point of quantification, we are very skeptical about our own models. You have different scenarios. In case of this, it will be like this. In case of that, it will be like that. But no one of us is sure what it exactly means.
Right.
We only see the trend is real, but we have difficulty in quantifying it.
Right.
So what beyond this general statement does all this work?
Well, it's not only general, which is what I said before, that you can say that in general with common sense you can tell all of the things, the overall results. But we have actually putting numbers to it right now. So going forward, when you look at climate change impacts, each climate model is just so different from the other. People are now doing what is known as ensemble, they're using ensembles of climate models. And they're developing ranges to guide their adaptation. So ranges of possible impacts. And that becomes one step removed from general. And you will never get something that is, there is no such thing as a 100% accurate prediction, right?
Yes.
But you can get to some kind of ranges of numbers that you can expect into the future, and that can help you. And in that case, and in that situation, when you want those ranges, the most probable ranges or something like that, then models like this are useful.
One more question. I was puzzled by the population figure in the beginning. California's population is supposed to increase from 35 million to 55 million up to 2050.
Yeah, that's part of this report over here, actually.
Where will all these people come from? Almost a doubling of California within 40 years? They make kids like that? Or
it's not possible. No, they come in. There's a lot of people moving into California, right?
So it's mainly immigration into California?
Yeah, people moving to California.
And which states get empty?
The Midwest.
Montana gets more empty, or?
I guess so, yeah.
Illinois.
Yeah, okay.
Northeast. I mean, that's actually based on population modeling and so on.
Trends.
At Berkeley, University of Berkeley, there's a lot of that stuff. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you for staying on a Friday night.